Hello everybody, work commitments are making it difficult for me to post written reviews of the plays in the second half of the Cambridge Shakespeare Festival this year, so I thought to save time I might move on to audio reviews. There's plenty of places on the website where you can leave feedback, particularly in the review section, so you can always drop a note to say whether you prefer audio to written ones. The first play I'm going to review as an audio is The Winter's Tale, directed by Simon Bell, performed at the Robinson College Gardens. Winter's Tale is one of my favourite Shakespeare plays. I say that about so many Shakespeare plays that it's a little bit of an inaccurate term, but to put it in context, I don't think that after King Lear he wrote anything better than The Winter's Tale, and if I had to choose only one, that's the play I'd choose. Now that's really saying something, considering that I'm placing it above The Tempest and Antony and Cleopatra, amongst others, and those two are also two of my very many favourites. But there's something about the balance of poetry, profundity, drama, the tragicomic genre, or more possibly more accurately, the tragicomic plus romance genre, the religious element of forgiveness via St. Paul is particularly well handled in this play. There are so many comments and metaphors on art in general, and Shakespeare's art in particular, alongside time and nature, and the way all these three things, time, nature and art, interact, that it's really just quite an amazing canvas, and one so wide and so deep that I always think it's really impossible to capture it all on stage. I have a similar problem with King Lear, come to that. I've seen versions of that play that do some of the things that mean so very much to me very well, or even brilliantly, but I've never seen a production that captures anywhere near all that it means to me. It's just not possible. And I find much the same with Winter's Tale. It's just not possible to capture it all. But the good thing about this is why you can enjoy so many different productions of the same play. They're all different, but they all add to the whole that elusive thing called King Lear or Winter's Tale actually is. And that's one of the strange things about a play. What actually is the Winter's Tale? Is it the text that we have surviving from Shakespeare, which might only be one of various variants that he penned, as was the case with Hamlet, for example? Is it the last one you saw? Is it a film you saw? Is it the first one you saw? It's actually an aggregation of all these things, so it's never the same thing. So when we say The Winter's Tale, as we believe The Winter's Tale to be, it's not a fixed object. It's something that changes as we grow through life, as our own experiences change our interpretation of the text, and more importantly, as the various dramatic enactions of it change the way we think about it and we remember it. So I still love going to see The Winter's Tale to increase my understanding of it, to increase my love of it. King Lear, which is, just in case you were wondering, my real very favourite Shakespeare play of all time, I've actually cut down on watching, drastically in fact, in the last few years, and I don't think I'll be going to many more, perhaps only one a year or so, until the modern obsessions of portraying it as a study in 21st century progressive Alzheimer's, which it isn't, and or depicting Lear as a murderer who kills his beloved fool, which he doesn't. Until both of these things pass, I don't think I'll be going to it as often as I'll be going to The Winter's Tale. So, having said all that, a basic review approach perhaps will get me back on track as I wander into my audio setting here and lose the structure of a written presentation already. A basic review approach would be, what are we presented with in this production and how effective is it? Does it work? We open with Gareth Llewellyn, one of his many roles, this one being audience guide, which merges into his wonderful portrayal as a chorus character, who explains so much to us about the play, more of which at the end of this review. I hope Gareth doesn't mind me saying that despite all the other roles he plays in the night, there's something particularly special about his choric role. It actually begins with him telling the audience the usual administration things, re-toilets and no smoking, which kicks us off, and which also means we don't have Mr. Bell's normal thou shalt not reign speech. A loss, but then Gareth's so entertaining in his role that you get losses and you get gains. The play opens with The play itself opens with a lot of party noises off stage, and then we come to Hermione, Leontes, and Polixenes on stage, where everything's very nice, just before, of course, as we all know, everything's about to go completely wrong. Leontes enters blindfolded, which obviously is extremely apt, and the blindfold stays on, does come off a bit, but it stays on at important moments in the opening scenes. It's on when he says his famous line about "you never spoke so fairly but once," and particularly I was thinking of there, it's still on when he says "hot, too hot," and the jealousy starts to take over his brain, and very soon completely takes control of his thoughts and actions. Hermione is not so very pregnant looking, I would have to say, which makes it slightly hard to accept a baby being born so soon after the scene. Perhaps I'm missing something there. And that aside, the three main characters at the opening are all absolutely excellent. Andrew Lancaster is a very good Polixenes. He's quite stately at the beginning, but then quickly won over into staying and partying. And just to jump a little bit later, his puzzlement and bewilderment as the situation unfolds, a really sort of unbelievable situation from his point of view, is very convincing. I also like, later on, to jump even further in the play, into the second half of the play, when he has his own scene of intemperate rage as he lashes out fiercely at his son and Perdita, which of course echoes back to what Leontes is about to do to Hermione by completely losing the plot. I should have mentioned that it's Charles Maguire playing Leontes and Ella Sawyers giving us a wonderful Hermione. All three characters, in fact, produce an ideal opening scene. It's a subtle and difficult piece of action to put over, but they do it in such a manner that you're carried away with it. I don't know how many plays in a row now Charles Maguire has had to lose his temper in violent rages. I think it must be six. It must be at least five, maybe six in a row. He's so very good at doing these rages, perhaps that's why he's always being asked to do it. It happens whether he's in a tragic role or a comic role, or in this case, by the end, both roles. But comic is very far away from the first half of this play. It is instead a classic tragic movement where a great man has a flaw which brings him down. It all happens so speedily. It's like classic Shakespeare tragedy at high speed. Maguire's Leontes is so good that it's almost unbearable to witness. Even during all his wickedest acts, you can't, as you sit in the audience, feel anything but pity for this once proud and pleasant king to be so reduced, to be so ridiculous and so unjust. And the first movement, the first half of the performance, ends in a startling visual image of Maguire in a contorted ball on stage with his white back pointing out to the audience, topped by the back of his head, which is pointing to the ground, glowing redly with rage, embarrassment, and the crushing realization of what he has done to his beloved wife and child. How did all this come about? Well, I was mentioning the excellent portrayal of the opening scene, where everybody's at a party and enjoying themselves. Then Leontes' jealousy erupts, and it has to be wild, all-consuming, and yet still a baseless passion. And at the same time, there has to be something for him to cling onto as evidence in his tortured mind. The text of the play provides this flimsiest connection, which has been portrayed in many different ways over the years. In this production, Hermione strokes her belly as she clings to her dear friend Polixenes. This is enough to send Leontes over the edge, and seeing the troubled look on his face, Hermione, the loving and faithful wife, rushes to attend to her husband. He, alas, is already out of her reach, and the reach of everyone else who tries to talk sense into him. Just following on with some other actor performances, Fergus Ratigan follows up his irrepressible portrayal of Sir Andrew Ogucheek in Twelfth Night with another splendid performance, this time as Camillo, one of Shakespeare's many loyal and wise servants, though in this case also a servant of God, which inspires all sorts of uses of the Bible. Many of these were for physical rather than spiritual reasons, and none more so than later on when Camillo chases the marauding bear off the stage by hitting the poor creature with his holy book. Ratigan thus brought a whole new meaning to the term Bible basher. I've mentioned the three of the main four characters, the other, or perhaps three of the main six characters, but Paulina is, of course, absolutely central to the play. And Zoe Lampricus brought a tremendous Paulina to our stage. At first, I have to admit, I thought she was too Olivia-like, this being her part in the earlier Twelfth Night this year. And given that she was dressed almost identically, and was again playing a powerful woman as she hit the stage, it was very difficult not to think of the previous role. Yet the feeling soon passed, as Zoe is such an excellent actress, and her interplay with Amelia, Amanda Madison, her husband Antigonus, the guard, and in fact everybody she dealt with, showed her to be the personification of, to quote the play, that audacious lady. When she intoned gravely and defiantly, "He shall not rule me," there was not a person who heard her who could ever doubt that this was the case. Jerome Dowling was an extremely capable husband, Antigonus, and although one naturally, as ever, bewails that good character's fate, at least his brave death allowed him to take over bare costume inhabiting duties later in the play. More of that later, however, as I leave you to ponder the psychological implications of becoming the creature who killed you. Leontes was extravagantly garbed for the oracle scene, and in a wonderful touch, he was seated and eating chocolate cake self-indulgently as Hermione pleaded her innocence. It was really quite a startling display of how far removed from reality Leontes had become. Hermione somehow kept her dignity throughout all this, despite hammer blow after hammer blow, to her esteem, to her family, to her life. As her innocence was proclaimed by Apollo, you felt a sense of relief, only for this to be completely overturned when the mad Leontes dismissed the oracle that he'd so thought would confirm his suspicions. He dismissed the oracle as baseless. Of course, he was soon to find out how wrong he was in everything. The death of Mamilius, who we never even see in this particular production, but then that's the price you pay for small casts. The death happening off stage, coming in and being reported by Amelia, brings him to his senses too late, and so much has gone wrong. His wife collapses, presumed dead. He's contorted on the floor. Paulina is soon comforting him, wiping his mouth as though he were a little child with his blindfold, which is a piece of cloth used meaningfully throughout the play, even when not being used as an actual blindfold. And 16 years later, we see her again spoon-feeding him. As the first half of the evening draws to a close, we see the bear coming round the garden to general surprise and delight. And at the same time, Gareth Llewellyn turns up in yet another guise when he plays the shepherd who discovers the abandoned baby. This was a very cleverly played scene, as the shepherd walked away from and then returned for the bairn, while simultaneously poor Antigonus was still being pursued by a bear in those garden paths behind the stage, deep set but still visible away from and above the onstage presence of the shepherd sitting at the front lip of the stage itself. Combining this part with his role of audience guide, Gareth the Shepherd then directed us to the interval mulled wine. That use of the garden area behind the actual stage reminds me that earlier on it was used just as effectively when Polixenes and Hermione were leaving the party and Leontes was muttering in jealous rage on stage. You saw them running behind and waving goodbye to the stage. Goodbye to the audience from behind and away from the stage just before Leontes uttered the words, "Already gone," and they disappeared into the bushes. After the break, we're in a whole new world. We have guitar music, we have lights on the trees, we have a completely different setting, which of course the college gardens are perfect for because it's a pastoral landscape that we're in now, where Andrew Skipper playing Florizel and Amanda Madison playing Perdita come gambling through the gardens to signal the change of tone from tragic to comic that was initiated originally by the bear's appearance. It's a very strange thing, this, that a murderous bear killing a very much loved character is actually a signal for a change from tragic to comic, but that gives you an idea of how subtle this play is. Florizel's extravagant stag's horns kept Leontes' cuckold delusions in one's mind, even as we basked in the release of tension that the second half brought. Meanwhile, Amanda Madison brings Perdita to life on stage in front of her eyes. In my review of A Midsummer Night's Dream, I mentioned the electric charge that Amanda has brought to the festival these last 2 years, and wrote of a particular style of characterization that she had introduced, or that had been partly introduced through her. As if to immediately show that this was only one side of her acting range, she plays two parts here, both completely removed from what I was writing about previously. And so different are her roles of Amelia and Perdita in The Winter's Tale that I had completely forgotten that she was doubling. Her Perdita was just right. Coming out of an Edenic pastoral idyll, her innocence, combined with the nobility of her heritage, means that Perdita comes across as a joyous creature full of tender love and care, and yet strong and poised at the same time. Possibly the highlight of her portrayal comes as she, it comes in the statue scene, as she goes to kiss the presumed dead queen's hand before Paulina jumps in to stop her by saying the colour's not yet dry. While Florizel's best moments for me came when he gave his speeches to the disguised Polixenes, albeit that these propelled his father into a near apoplectic fit. Not long after that, we came to the part of the play that, first of all, most impressed me, and also later, in between my two viewings of the play, started to concern me. Two different things happen at once. One is a wonderful effect of tableaus, with Gareth Llewellyn again back on in chorus role, taking photographs and explaining to the audience what's happening as the characters on stage freeze frame into important action moments that he describes and describes time's effect on. Sorry, I didn't say that very well. If this was written, I could go back and change it, but I can't. You have to go and see it to get the full effect anyway. The reasons I became somewhat hesitant about it was that the bear was reintroduced back into the stage at this point, his second major appearance, and there's a third one still to come. The bear was part of the photographs, and it was extremely funny when I saw it, but later on I wondered if this was overdoing the comedy. Now, I thought then, and I'm absolutely sure now, that the reason the bear is reintroduced twice in the second part of the play is that so much has been cut to fit it into the time that seems to be allocated at Robinson College. I don't know if there's a rule or not, but Coriolanus was also quite short. But anyway, to make up for the bits that have to be cut and to get the balance between tragedy and comedy correct, Simon Bell has laid on this scene and laid on the bear to bring comedy to it, but at the same time is doing something very serious with time. I had begun to think that the bear was too much. He comes on later while the scene is being, where the stage is being set up for the statue scene, and it's an absolutely beautiful set, I should point out here, really wonderful and well worth the setting up. The bear comes on then to distract the audience from what's going on, though the second time I saw it, our chorus figure was actually drawing attention to everything that was going on at the same time as the bear was distracting from it with his various different dances. There was lots of punning at the time, the bear being barely believable, and at the same time Camillo is back on and Fergus Ratigan gets his trusty Bible and starts bashing the bear. All of these things are going on at once, and I began to think in between seeing the play for the first and the second time that it had gone too far and that it had taken away from all the sort of profundity and philosophy that I love about the play, and all the concentration on art as the statue comes to life. She is in fact doing what characters do to Shakespeare's text every night any play is performed. Actors go on stage and bring the words to life from the page and turn what is cold into something warm and living. So I worried about all that kind of thing, but I suspect it was just the old pedant scholar of me coming out. Because to be slightly fair to myself, though, the first time I saw it, there was a false ending. A guitar had gone missing, an odd recurrence of a similar thing happening at the end of Titus Andronicus in the same venue last year, also on the opening night. Anyway, I wouldn't have known that a guitar had gone missing in Winter's Tale, because obviously, it being the first night, nobody knew that there was supposed to be a guitar there, except for those on stage. However, maybe I noticed something subliminally that made me start to doubt the play in some way, though I think it's probably more likely that the rational part of my brain, the reader of a Shakespeare's play rather than the theatre-goer, started to assert control over my thoughts as I looked back on what had undoubtedly been a wonderful experience at the time. My second viewing confirmed that this experience was a genuine one, conjured up by a wonderfully balanced production that, for all its cuts, and yes, there is much poetry, meaning, and even characters that I miss, this version maintains the tragic comedy plus romance and the wonder that this magnificent play provides. I should never have doubted my first impressions, and I'm very glad that they were proved to be right. On second viewing. And so I probably missed things out here. It's very difficult, I find, now doing an audio rather than a written, so I will write this up at some point. But here's something that shows you my first thoughts, albeit in a somewhat rambling mode. Hope you liked it. Go and see the show if you haven't. If you've seen it, go and see it again, because it's just as good or even better second time around. Well done to all.